This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. It's well known that many workplaces may harbor carcinogens, and long-term exposure might place you at risk for developing cancer. But can your job actually give you cancer? Well, here with some answers is our Dr. Michael Lax. He is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and the medical director of the Occupational Health Clinical Center at Upstate Medical University. And Dr. Gerald Abraham, he's a professor of pathology and the director of environmental and occupational pathology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate your being here. So, Dr. Lax, let me start with you. So your job can actually give you cancer? Tell us about that.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of things that people are exposed to in the workplace, and it's known that a number of them can are linked to increased risk of cancer, and there's a lot of other substances where it's possible or probable that there's a link, but there's just not enough evidence to make it definitive.
Do we know what percentage at this point of work-related of cancer is work-related?
Yeah, people have been arguing about that since the early 80s.
I'm sure.
Debating that on a lot of levels. But so there's a number of studies that were done. The estimates range from lows around 4% to highs more around 10 or 12%. But the big three cancers that are known in the United States to be related to work are lung cancer, maybe as much as 25%, bladder cancer, and mesothelioma, which is asbestos-related.
So when we talk about those three, give us an example of how and where you might contract those things. What kinds of occupations would lead you to any of those three?
Yeah, well, in terms of lung cancer, it sort of intuitively makes sense that lung cancer might be one of the cancers most at risk for people who are working, because a lot of materials are inhaled and they're deposited directly onto the lung tissue, so they have a chance to react with it. So, asbestos is probably the best known and the most common sort of carcinogen that people continue to be exposed to, even though people may think that this is something that disappeared in the United States a long time ago. People continue to be exposed to asbestos.
Now, why is that, though? Because I understand that there's all these asbestos containment programs where if you find there's asbestos in a building, you kind of stay away or you do things to mitigate exposure.
Well, I think it's a couple things. I mean, one thing is that people get exposed unknowingly so that, for example, they don't expect it. So they go into a building, for example, say you're a telephone worker or a computer person, you're running wires into a commercial building that's kind of old, and there's asbestos in the spaces where they're running those wires in. They're getting exposed that way. So it's kind of unexpected. On the other hand, there are people who are doing asbestos directly. They know they're working with asbestos abatement, and they're just not doing the job correctly. I mean, here in Syracuse a few years ago, there was a father and son team that were convicted of and sent to prison for 20 years for running an asbestos abatement company that was basically exposing all their workers and then everybody who came into the building afterward to the bad job that they were doing.
So that's horrible. Yeah. So you said there were two other types of diseases also. You mentioned bladder cancer and then mesothelioma.
Right.
So just briefly, where would your exposure be to bladder cancer?
Oh, bladder cancer has been known for quite a long time because, again, it's an organ that makes sort of intuitive sense as a target organ for a lot of different carcinogens, because it's sort of like a reservoir for urine. In the urine, a lot of toxic materials are excreted that way, so they have a chance to sort of sit there and expose the bladder to it. And so, dyes are a well-known one. One that we've dealt with recently is with coal tar pitch, which is found, for example, in aluminum smelters and other places.
And the last one, mesothelioma, that's also to do with asbestos exposure.
Mesothelioma is a rare cancer that is linked to pretty much one particular exposure, which is asbestos, and really there's no other known exposure that causes it.
Dr. Abraham, why then is this so important in terms of understanding, what cancers are work-related? What's the significance? I mean, it seems self-evident, but in your mind, what's the significance?
Well, it's really important. I wanted to pick up on a couple of things that you mentioned and that Dr. Lax mentioned also. It's really important because when an individual is diagnosed with cancer, then usually that diagnosis is made by the surgeon doing a biopsy and sending it to a pathologist, and then the pathologist is responsible for properly identifying and classifying that cancer. The pathologists also need to be sensitive that when they receive a biopsy, sometimes there's evidence in that biopsy besides the cancer. For example, if someone has a lung surgery for a cancer, there's a lung tissue involved as well in that surgery, and often it has clues that a person has had exposure to things like asbestos or other dusts and things like that, that a pathologist can identify. So it's really important for the pathologists to be aware of this and for the clinicians and the patients to say, well, is there any clue in there? What evidence is there of exposures I might not have remembered? And it also leads into the importance of the physicians collecting a very thorough history of occupational exposures and even residential exposures that that person has had throughout their entire life, not just during the few weeks before their surgery. Sometimes you'll see in the medical charts, under the little heading of occupation, it may say retired, and that's all it says about a person's occupation. So as physicians, we're generally doing a poor job of collecting occupational information unless the people see somebody like Dr. Lax, who takes a thorough occupational history. Now, the reason it's important to identify these things is not only for that person. Once you have the cancer, it's very unlikely that knowing that it's related to your occupation will affect how it's treated, but it's really important for the individual because they may be eligible for some compensation, and if it's work-related, the responsibility of different insurance plans comes into effect. If it's work-related, for example, it may be that they should have it covered by workers' compensation insurance rather than their regular medical insurance, and sometimes the medical regular insurers battle with workers' comp for who's responsible, trying to put the cost onto the other one. Also, if it's identified that a certain workplace can cause exposures that result in cancer, it's very important for the other workers at that place to be notified and to prevent further exposure. And the most far-ranging thing is if there's a new exposure that hasn't previously been recognized to be related to a cancer or any other disease, is that prevention of exposure by better regulation can follow from the proper identification. And as the other couple of things you mentioned earlier on was that about long-term exposures resulting in cancers, and that's especially relevant to the disease that Dr. Lax and you talked about a minute ago about mesothelioma, which is a rare cancer in the general population. Maybe one or two cases of this cancer per million people in the population per year will get this if they haven't had asbestos exposure that's recognized. Whereas in a heavily exposed asbestos workers, you may have 10 or more percent of the people followed for their lifetime that die of this disease. So anybody can do some calculations to see that's a great increase from 1 or 2 per million to 10% of the people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Michael Lax and Dr. Gerald Abraham, and we're talking about workplace carcinogens. But so obviously, Dr. Abraham just elucidated very clearly why it's important to know where the cancer came from. I mean, unrelated, I mean, even beyond the idea of helping the individual with insurance coverage, to know if we can actually mitigate a circumstance where they were working or put into place regulations that would make a difference. Why currently is it so difficult? What are the roadblocks to quantifying this kind of data?
Well, there's a lot of them. You know, I think the United States doesn't do a lot of recording of or documenting of exposures in the sense that we're not really sure what people are exposed to in the workplace. When manufacturers or employers want to introduce a material into the workplace, they're not required to document that they're doing it or that there's a health a health problem related to it. And you know, we really don't document people's health histories or not health histories, but occupational histories during their course of their health evaluations. So you know, we don't have there's no real easy mechanism to do the sorts of epidemiologic studies to really gather large groups of people where we know what they've been exposed to, how much they've been exposed to, for how long, all in a common place so that you could actually do decent studies.
Is someone studying this currently, though? I mean, you always hear about OSHA, and there's so much emphasis on OSHA, you know, the whole idea of occupational safety and health. the concept being that we're trying, at least, or at least maybe it's a name only, but we're trying to make an impact here.
Yeah, but the problem is huge in the sense that you know, you have something like 140,000 different substances that are in common use in industry, and about 2% of them have been tested for their carcinogenic potential. So really, you have 98%, which we have really zero information on about that. So yes, people are certainly studying sorts of different kinds of occupational hazards, but the job is huge, and you know, there's a lot of, I think. In terms of studies, you need money, you need financing and backing to do the sorts of studies. And I think most of that, the financing goes to sort of looking for things where there's a lot that's already known, as opposed to doing more what you might think of as exploratory work in areas where there's not a lot that's known.
But so, it's been estimated that we have between 24,000 and 60,000 deaths secondary to occupational exposure of some sort. It's not all cancer, am I correct?
No, it's cancer.
That's all cancer.
Right.
I mean, those are staggering numbers. To think that there isn't more of an effort being made is somewhat shocking.
Well, yeah, I think so. But, you know, that's sort of the common lament of those of us who are in the field of occupational health, that worker health is something that takes second place or third place or fourth place in terms of national priorities and national attention. I mean, if you just look at it from a funding perspective, you look at OSHA and NIOSH, which are the sort of flip sides of a coin. OSHA regulates workplaces and sets standards. NIOSH, which is with the CDC affiliated organization, really does the research and or funds research that then provides the information for OSHA to make regulations. And, you know, the amount of funding they receive relative to other agencies involved in environmental safety and consumer safety and a bunch of other agencies, really very tiny. So worker health is, even though the exposures to workers are in most cases are orders of magnitude higher than what people experience in the environment, the amount of resources that go into studying it, looking at it, preventing it are really quite small.
So, I mean, what if you are a worker and you're listening to this out there? Two questions I have is, what do you recommend someone do in terms of either evaluating their particular workplace? Is there some way they can gather information in terms of their exposure? That's number one. And number two, what if you're diagnosed with a cancer, and does it affect your treatment in any way? You know, or let's say you can still continue to work in that environment. What should you be doing proactively to protect yourself?
Well, I guess there's two levels of prevention that we're talking about. There's primary prevention and there's secondary prevention. Secondary prevention is for somebody who's been exposed. Are there tests that can be done to actually predict or see if they have a propensity or possibly the cancer developing? And those opportunities are pretty limited. But low-dose CT scanning is one that shows some promise for lung cancer. On the other hand, I think the main emphasis should be on primary prevention, which is the reduction of and elimination of carcinogenic exposures in the workplace. And yes, workers have rights in terms of right to know what they work with. And there's now, with the internet and things, there's a lot of opportunities for them to sort of figure that out a bit more. But the problem comes with, okay, once they figured it out, what can they do about it? And that's the more difficult question.
But the point is, they should be in some way trying to determine if their workplace is carcinogenic, and if it is, what they can be doing to protect themselves, obviously, because you don't want to end up with the cancer and then having to basically deal with all the sequelae of that.
That's right? Correct. If time allows, I could give you just one quick anecdote. Just this morning on my way to work, I drove past an area where they were doing some road construction that people were using heavy equipment to tear up the blacktop asphalt paving, heating it up, grinding it up, and it was a very dusty operation. There were clouds of smoke coming out of the machines, and the operators of the machines were just sitting there in the smoke without any protection whatsoever. And the chemicals in asphalt include hydrocarbons and things like that that are known carcinogens, yet there are regulations, but they're not being enforced. So if the workers aren't informed, or their foreman says, well, that's too much trouble to provide adequate respiratory protection, there's a flaw, obviously, as Dr. Lax was talking about, in the funding for OSHA to do the inspections and regulations of these things, and in the employers supervising it for not paying attention to that. But ultimately, they're responsible.
So it continues to be a real issue, obviously, especially with the numbers you've quoted. Well, I want to thank you for both coming in and at least highlighting the importance of this kind of thing. And hopefully, if people are listening and are in an environment where they have some concerns about the amount of carcinogens they may be exposed to, that maybe they'll take some proactive efforts to protect themselves. Thanks so much again. My guests have been Dr. Michael Lax. He is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine. He's also the medical director of the Occupational Health Clinical Center at Upstate Medical University. And Dr. Gerald Abraham, professor of pathology and director of environmental and occupational pathology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.